from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, the Department of Homeland Security announced yesterday that passengers traveling to the United States on foreign airlines from certain Muslim-majority countries may not bring laptops or any electronic device larger than a cell phone in their carry-on luggage. We'll discuss the ban and its impacts. And then at 9:30, we'll talk about the turmoil at San Francisco-based ride-hailing company Uber after sexual harassment charges, lawsuits, and this week's departure of its president, Jeff Jones. That's all coming up on Forum after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security announced that passengers traveling to the United States on foreign airlines from 10 airports in 8 Muslim-majority countries may no longer bring laptops, tablets, and other large electronic devices in their carry-on bags. Citing evaluative intelligence, reports from the DHS call the measures necessary to combat terrorist groups that it says are targeting commercial aircraft and working on ways to smuggle explosives in consumer items. The UK announced a similar ban covering 6 Muslim-majority countries just hours later. We want to discuss the ban and its potential impacts with Alex Davies, Senior Associate Editor with Wired, who joins us in studio. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And also, Richard Bloom is with us. He's Chief Academic Officer and Director of Terrorism, Intelligence, and Security Studies at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. He joins us this morning from Prescott, Arizona. Welcome to the program, Richard Bloom.
And good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to have you both with us. Let me begin with Alex Davies, who I said is here with us in studio. And this is essentially being described by United States officials as not related to the Trump executive order. It's hard not to associate it with that, isn't it?
It's true because, as you said, these are Muslim-majority countries, but the list of airports and cities that this new electronics ban actually doesn't really line up with the what people are calling the travel ban or even the Muslim ban. This new one includes countries like Turkey and Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
All our friends.
All our friends. The United Arab Emirates, that's cities like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, plus Qatar. So it's a different group of countries. But
and it's different region. In the UK. They have Tunisia and Lebanon on this list, and they have deleted a few of those that we have on our list in the United States.
Exactly. They don't have Abu Dhabi or Dubai. They don't have the Emirates. They do have Saudi Arabia. So it's a little hard to pin down where these choices for countries are coming from.
It's also hard to pin down, Richard Bloom, what prompted this. Now, we're being told that there was intelligence that showed the Islamic State is developing a bomb that's hidden. There's also been concern about al-Qaeda in Yemen and Ibrahim al-Arasi, the bomb maker, as he's best known, and other flights like from Somalia that blew up and so forth. But it seems to be coming at us almost suddenly, really.
Well, from an aviation security point of view, I think we're dealing with intelligence information. People involved in aviation security look at the threat, look at vulnerabilities. They put them together. They get a risk assessment. It's an ever-changing process, and our layers of security should be ever-changing as well. If the process worked appropriately, the countries were looking at the airlines, the airports, and all the rest of it, and what you can and cannot bring on with you into the cabin of an aircraft, that should be substantiated by appropriate intelligence information.
What about, Alex Davies, the argument that this may have something more to do with the economics, that these foreign airlines get government subsidies, American airlines don't. They're hurt with big and first-class revenue by this ban. I mean, there is a lot of speculation that economic protectionism is at the heart of this.
It's an interesting theory, and the root of it comes from airlines like Emirates and Qatar Airways and Etihad. These are the ones that are flying out of the UAE and out of Qatar. And American airlines have long had a big problem with these airlines because, as they point out, those airlines get very large subsidies from their home governments. They're basically they're borderline nationalized airlines, and thus they can fly back and forth. You know, they scoop up a lot of that more impressive first-class business revenue that otherwise airlines like Delta and United and American might get. And what really bugs these airlines is that the United States, through its Export-Import Bank, gives these airlines big discounts on planes that they buy from companies like Boeing.
And Richard Bloom, maybe you can help us through the logic of this. I mean, you can still put a terrorist who has the intent of blowing up an airplane can still put a bomb into a checked bag or into the cargo hold in some way, or for that matter, can fly from South America or Hamburg or, you know, pretty much anywhere across the globe and make connection.
Unfortunately, we live in a world of alternative facts where true is false and false is true, and a lot of that's part of our political dialogue lately. But I think we only have four issues or four opportunities or four possibilities here. We either have a substantiated specific threat, we have a substantiated more general threat, which is why a number of countries and airlines and all the rest of it are being looked at, or we do have political motivations or economic, and then, of course, you have a combination of all of that as well. But I get back to the point that with aviation security, you continue to change your security stance, your layers of security in terms of your technologies, the people involved with that, what you're allowed to take on the aircraft with you, and things of that sort. And based on the threat, the vulnerability, and coming up with risk assessment. So although it's easy to look at political and economic explanations, there's a pure almost a scientific approach to coming up with what the security procedure should be.
Yeah, but let me go to the heart of my question. I mean, a terrorist can still fly through Europe or South America and do terrible damage that way as opposed to flying from one of these countries that's been listed here.
Well, you know, at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, where I work, we game these kinds of situations. We give people information based on the intelligence information, the simulated intelligence information. How would you change policy? How would you change operations? The essence of your question is really based on skepticism. Can we ever be totally sure, totally safe? Obviously not. But with the information you get, you do the best you can in analyzing and coming up with the appropriate security stance.
Now, Alex Davies, there's logic to this, though, that I'm missing. I mean, when you think about it, you consider all the alternatives. How do you read it?
So many of these bans, it's hard to pin down exactly what the information is. And speaking with former security experts, the sense I get is that what you do is you pick out the most specific threat, and then you throw in a couple of other things that you're going to block as well. And one idea there is to hide a little bit of what exactly you know. So if you think someone's trying to bring an explosive on through a laptop, you throw in cameras, DVD players, that sort of thing. If you think it's going to come on one airline from one place, you include a few others in the region and that area just to be a little bit safer.
Well, I'd like to point out, just adding
it's Richard
to that,
Bloom. Go ahead.
In terms of the general public and what they should be understanding about the last 24, 48 hours, is that at any particular point in time, there are many, many pieces of information all suggesting threat and changes in threat. Not all of them are true. Not all of them are false. So you have to pick and choose which one's going to act on and which one's not. So at any particular point in time, even if you haven't collected additional information, you may have a new interpretation, which leads to a change in security posture.
Well, this new order, this U.S. ban, as well as the one from the U.K., has a great deal of effect on many, not only on business and tourism and the airline industry, but certainly on academics. Many take these flights, and many journalists and business people, lawmakers for that matter, use these long flights as ways of doing work on their laptops, and that will no longer be possible unless they can transfer all this stuff to their smartphones. You may want to comment on this, and in fact, if you do, or if you have a question, I invite you to join the program. By the way, there's a lot of concern about kids also who use laptops on airplanes. Many people affected by this. Your thoughts are welcome, and let me invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available now. Number is 866-733-6786. If you have thoughts on this ban, if you have questions or comments, join us now at that number. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. And this is a half-hour segment, so if you'd like to contribute to the conversation or have a question or comment, now would be the time for you to call. You can also, of course, join us with your questions or comments by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply clicking on this segment or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm also wondering, and maybe we should go to you on this, Richard Bloom, if there is new intelligence that we can detect in this, there was a raid on Yemen, and there's Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which has been, as I indicated earlier, allegedly and certainly reportedly from good intelligence that we have, developing these kinds of things along with ISIS. What do we know in terms of where the dots connect?
Well, I think the important point here, maybe we have new intelligence, maybe we have new interpretations of existing intelligence information. There's no question, and it's becoming more and more commonly understood among the general public. Certainly since 9/11, there's applied research and development activities going on among certain terrorist organizations, terrorist individuals directly or indirectly involved in terrorism, coming up with new ways to target aviation, almost like it's a fetish. Almost like that kind of thing. And in terms of how much ISIS might be involved, I think what's important here, too many people look at ISIS or Al-Qaeda or many other groups almost like football or baseball teams. What you have more often are people who interchangeably move from one entity to another in terms of how many resources they have, what the goals might be, and what the targets might be. So I think that's part of the discussion, too.
And again, Richard Bloom is Chief Academic Officer and Director of Terrorism, Intelligence, and Security Studies at Embry-Riddle Aeronautics University. He's with us this morning from Prescott University. And Alex Davies here in studio with us, a senior associate editor with Wired. Anything really with a battery and a flash, includes smartphones, can be used for, shall we say, nefarious purposes, Alex? Kent?
That seems to be the idea. The idea really is that a clever bomb maker can disguise an explosive as a battery. And that's where you see the difference between smartphones being allowed in the cabin and larger electronics like laptop, cameras, DVD players being forced into the cargo hold. It's simply a difference of size.
Isn't there also a sense, though, that the future of aviation security is more in passenger profiling and pre-screening?
I think that's what people who work at Israeli airports would say, where the security is notoriously tough. They say it's ridiculous to try and screen everybody 100%, which is more or less the TSA's approach to doing it. They're much more about studying the people who are coming into their airports. It's a much more invasive security process, but it's less of a looking at everybody the same way, more trying to pick out individual targets.
I'm sorry, finish your thought.
If I could comment on that one, based on the latest scientific research, I think there are significant error rates, whether you base your security approach more on technology or whether you base it more on social science, psychology, things of that sort. I think the real discussion comes down to how much of each you use, and that should be based, again, on the information you have about the threat and vulnerability where you're running air operations.
I'm going to go to your phone calls. Let me first read a couple of comments from different sides of the aisle, so to speak. Kurt writes, great idea. We can ban anything from anywhere. It's all about controlling our borders. The American people need to know their government is putting their intentions first and foreign interests last. Colleen writes, it's all security theater to make travelers feel safer. I believe the ban is politically and monetarily motivated. Let's hear from our callers. We begin with Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Jerry, the Oakland Cowboy. There is they say banning the computers from carry-on because they're afraid that there might be a threat of a bomb or something. Well, if you put it in the belly of the plane, the bomb would still be on board if there was. What's up with that?
What's up with that? Well, we raised that question before with Richard Bloom. And Richard Bloom, you want to tackle it again from your perspective?
Well, I think the real point here, going back to 9/11, all it took were box cutters, basically, a pretty primitive technology to get the job done from a terrorist perspective. I think any time you have objects going onto an aircraft with the right thinking and the right analysis, one can come up with an operational approach to increase the threat to that particular aircraft. So you can look at what's in the cabin, what's in cargo, maybe nothing should be in either. But regardless of that, it really comes down to casing out a situation and coming up with a terrorist operational plan. And just like there's applied research and development from a terrorism point of view, there's plenty of evidence to show how individuals related to terrorism engage in surveillance and reconnaissance of particular airports, looking at security procedures. Anytime there's a security violation, it's almost like a free experiment. You see how people respond to that. So I think that's the real context of what's happening here.
And here's more of your calls. Johnny joins us. Johnny, you're on the air. Hello?
You know, one of the things, now I'm a fire service man myself, so I'm very experienced with IEDs, And when I hear someone taking the technological jump and start using things that we use in our daily life that we actually rely on, a lot of us take a second glance at and don't even think twice about it. You know, let it be your iPhone, your iPad, or, you know, your Dell laptop. Anything along those lines, to the average day Joe, that just looks like a standard item that someone would carry. But to, let's say, TSA, to someone, to the extent where they're afraid of a bottle of lotion, now you're bringing in, okay, now you're going to be afraid of a cell phone, you know, camera, laptop. What's going to be the approach for the people who, again, have to work in the air, you know? They spend 20, 30 hours a week in airtime, not just working, but in airtime, getting across the country trying to deal with, let's say, you know, legislatures and anything along those lines.
Well, you raised one of the central questions, Johnny, and let me go back to you, Alex Davies, on this. I mean, a lot of people are going to be really put out by this big time.
No question. It's going to be a major pain, especially since the flights coming from this part of the world to the U.S. are long. They're 12, 13, 14-hour flights, and they're dominantly business class routes. These are people who are moving between other parts of the world and the U.S., and they want to be able to work while in the air. And it's not just not being able to work, but it's the risk of what happens when you put all of your stuff in the luggage. There's the risk of theft. Some of these cameras, these computers contain valuable information. They're just
personal
expensive
data. And some people are activists and some people are, you know, doing political journalism work and so forth. It's in their computers.
Absolutely. I can think of a lot of people flying from these parts of the world to the U.S. who would not want to let their electronics out of their hands for good reason.
And what do we say about the fact, if I go to you on this, Richard Bloom, that TSA has enhanced their pat-down just a couple of weeks ago in U.S. airports. 2015, they found fake weapons and explosives getting through security screeners about 95% of the time.
Yeah, I am familiar with that study, and it really shows how things have to be reevaluated in terms of threat, vulnerability, and risk. But a really important point here, ultimately, terrorism is psychological in nature. It's not the people who are injured or killed. It's not what's damaged or destroyed. It's the psychological effect on people who learn about all of that. The very fact that we're having this show and that procedures are being put in place to inconvenience travelers throughout the world, that's an attack on our economy. It's an attack on our culture, and it's really a win for terrorism, regardless of what happens next.
I'm going to read a comment from Candy, who talks about traveling with kids. She says, back in the day, because I want to read this comment particularly because I was reading someone on the or hearing somebody on the BBC saying this is a form of terrorism against parents because they have to have their kids with with these devices in front of them. Candy writes, to those traveling with kids, back in the day, we bought books, coloring and drawing materials and games where you have to play with each other and interact. If anything, this will force people to interact with each other. Let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Alabama and welcome Ani. Morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Okay. So my question, I guess, is one of agency. If this is such an important topic and the current administration actually has to pass policy on something like this, then why, is there evidence to support that this has actually been effective in the past? And if not, why is there not? Like, there should be some sort of tangible, data that's been formed from, like, years of collecting all this stuff. Like, has this actually worked in the past? And if so, what are the effects of it? I'm not super sure. I just tuned in. But.
Well, it's a good question. And Richard Bloom, any data to go on here empirically?
Well, I'd like to point out that the history of aviation terrorism actually goes back to the late 1920s. There are actually unclassified textbooks and articles about that particular history. The problem with coming up with empirical validation and substantiated techniques that will work and will work well throughout time is that the history of terrorism shows that after a successful terrorist attack, too often the targets of the attack work on meeting it next time, while the people who implemented the attack are already on to developing a new approach, a new perspective, a new operation. So because of that, it's hard to build up a casebook of cause and effect when it comes to security procedures.
I'm struck, though, Alex Davies, by the fact that 9/11 came from Hamburg and the shoe bomber came from Paris and the Nigerian underwear bomber came from Amsterdam. In other words, we've got a lot of, terrorists or terrorist attempts that are out of Europe. And again, You can just go through the hub and go through Europe, and you don't have to fly out of Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia directly.
That seems to me to be a glaring hole in applying this sort of ban in this way. And a lot of it's hard to pin down exactly why these countries were picked, why these particular airlines are affected. And I think anybody would understand the reasons. Intelligence agencies don't want to share all of their thinking here. But it makes it a lot harder to understand as a traveler or as somebody who's going to be affected why they're doing this. That makes it a little harder to accept.
Well, William wants to know, he says, so it appears the concern is that ISIS can put a bomb in a laptop. Please explain why current security measures for laptops are insufficient.
Ideally, they should be able to find it. I think part of the worry here is that these are flights leaving from other parts of the world, places where TSA procedures and electronics and screening operations aren't in place there. And I think that I'm sure the Department of Homeland Security plays a role or assists or, you know, has some say in how that all works. But I think part of this has to do with the fact that these are flights coming to the U.S. from other countries.
And again, Alex Davies is Senior Associate Editor with Wired. And our next caller is just back from Abu Dhabi. Michael, you're on. Morning.
Hi, Michael. I'm a big fan. Thanks, as always. Yeah, I just came back a couple of weeks ago from Hyderabad in India, and I took Etihad, and I had to fly through Abu Dhabi. All in all, it was about 32 hours, but this particular flight was around 16, 17 hours. Now, most people in the plane were either high-tech workers in Silicon Valley or, you know, their families. And I can't help wonder if there's any kind of, like, intent directed towards a part of the country here that is not particularly a big fan of this new administration. Just wondering, you know, because many, 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 many people who take these long flights, they're actually their final destinations in India and the high-tech companies there.
Well, I thank you for raising that question. I don't know if Richard or Alex wants to respond. Alex, you want to say something here?
Sure. Again, I can't say what the exact motives are here. I'd be inclined to say there probably is real intelligence indicating that this is a threat. But it's the same idea with the economic argument around the United Arab Emirates Airlines, which is that because this administration and this political climate has cast so much suspicion on this part of the world, it's not surprising to say that, even if there is a threat, what are the real motivations here?
Well, I'm looking at a comment from a listener who says it's possible there is a legitimate threat, but with this administration, how can we tell? We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank Alex Davies, again, Senior Associate Editor with Wired. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Richard Bloom, who is with us from Prescott, Arizona, Chief Academic Officer and Director of Terrorism, Intelligence, and Security Studies at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you as well.
And thank you, our listeners, and we're going to come up on a discussion about Uber. Lots happening with Uber, a lot of turmoil. Their president has just left after 6 months. Eric Newcomer will join us, a reporter for Bloomberg Business. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.